Dave Garraway's personality and his approach to both radio and TV have set the tone for what has become known as the Chicago School of Broadcasting. We're very pleased to have a chance to visit with the dean of the school. Dave Garraway, welcome back to the campus.
I refuse to be the dean. He's an executive officer, and I'm not an executive type. I'm one of the older students in the school, I think.
Well, we shall learn from your wisdom. And I think over the years, people did learn from Dave Garraway's wisdom.
Well, I suppose that I have disseminated some knowledge. I can't help, because I've been talking for 30 years now, and I figured it out. And I must have said something in then all that time of some wisdom, and a lot of people listen to television and radio, so I must have disseminated some wisdom. Yes, I go along with that. How much, I don't know. What quality, I don't know.
A lot, and the fine quality, I would say. Where did it all start for Dave Garraway?
Well, it started in my closet in my bedroom at home when I was about nine. I was a child electronic wonder. At age eight, I changed some wires in a circuit diagram and Robert's regenerative receiver, and my father said, you know, that makes that circuit into a different kind of circuit, and it's patentable, and he got a patent on it for me as a junior, as a, in trust, worth nothing, but just as a gesture. This gave me an idea that I was some stuff electronically. And at the same time, I got taken to a radio station, and I saw a man through a glass wall talk into a microphone, and it was the same sound that we heard at home, WNAC Boston. And I came home transfixed, kind of. And I fixed up my closet with blankets on the walls, and I had put a box up there, and I didn't have any equipment, but I've made a few announcements too, and then gradually I've got some equipment, and I got a boy on the next street, and first thing you know, we had a, what you can see if there's a mutual public address system between us, and we would talk back and forth, and that was big stuff to us. And that kind of fell away, and I forgot all about that until one time in New York. You know, there are moments in your life when your whole life hangs in the balance, and the decision is yes or no, go or no go. And I know where several of mine have been. Most people know where they've been. Mine was turning my head to look back through the swinging door, the revolving door of the 63rd Street YMCA in New York, to look to see if I had any mail in the mailbox. I didn't, but standing at the desk there was a man who had been chasing the same girl I'd been chasing years before, for years, and he got her and I didn't. Which was all right with me by this time. This was 5 years later. But I wanted to be friendly. I'd never said anything to him. I just wanted to shoot him, that's all. So I went back, introduced myself. He said, do you play bridge? Yes. Well, we need a fourth. Come along. And the bridge game contained a girl who was tall, very handsome, and who about 2 o'clock in the morning in the bridge game said, I think we better break it up because I have to fire 30 pages and hire 30 more tomorrow morning. And I said, you sound like a librarian. And she said, no, I'm head of guest relations for NBC. Page boys, I mean. And I looked at her and I said, 29. I want one of those jobs. Uh-huh. And at 8:45... by gosh, I had been fitted for a uniform, and at 9 o'clock I was standing on the 8th floor by side of Studio 8H, a full-fledged NBC page, and at 9:15, Lowell Thomas walked in, and I almost became unconscious. Not quite. There was another page there to save me from falling over when Thomas said, "What studio am I in?" I just opened my mouth, but no sound came out. And the other page said, "E," and Thomas went on in. I blessed him for that E many times.
So you really started at the almost, I guess that is just about the bottom of broadcasting, isn't it? A page
at one of the stations? Well, NBC was taking in all of its employees through the page and guide route at that time.
I see.
It was public policy kind of thing.
Now, was this in Boston?
New York.
In New York, that's right.
Yeah.
You said New York.
I'd gone to New York to sell a book that I had written
to
school teachers. They had at NBC an announcer's class. Well, into that I went, and in one of the tests, after about 6 months, I took the test and finished. The man in charge said 27th out of 28. And I just think he made a typographical error, that's all. That's my opinion. Because the next test I won, and that was for not a 100-watt station, which the first one had been, but for a 50,000-watt station, KDKA in Pittsburgh.
Ah, uh-huh.
And I went down there and became special events director. Lucky again, the manager called me in, interviewed me, and said, "Well, can you ad lib?" And I said, "I think so." He said, "Well, go down to the studio and make believe that you're reporting the National Open Golf Tournament. Bobby Jones is two strokes ahead, and you're coming up in the 17th hole." Little did he know that I had a one handicap golf score. And so I went down there and I ad-libbed and ad-libbed and ad-libbed and ad-libbed and ad-libbed. And the tournament finished. I awarded the prizes, and it was about over an hour when the engineer said, "I can see him on the phone." And he got up and went out. And he came back and he said, "Hey, you might as well stop. They've all gone home. They've forgotten all about me." He said, "He does fine. I got the job." And they all went home.
So KDKA Pittsburgh was where you made your really professional radio debut then on the air.
For about 9 months, I was special events director, broadcasting from the tops of broadcasting towers and bridges, and actually once from a submarine at the confluence, I wonder if I can get this right, of the Allegheny, the Monongahela, and the Ohio Rivers. Can you imagine a U.S. submarine getting up there? It did. And we were under the water and broadcast from it. But then I made the happy decision to see Ransom Sherman. I thought he was so funny that I just had to see the man in Chicago. So on my vacation, I went up there. And while I was there, the chief announcer said, "Do you want to take an audition? We're needing a man here." And my eyes glowed brightly, and I took an audition, won, and moved to Chicago, where I got a soap opera. And held it for a few months until the Navy reached out its long, friendly hand and took me for four and a half years or so.
And you were an announcer then on the soap opera?
Yeah.
Or not an actor, but an announcer?
An announcer.
Which one was that? Can you recall?
Yeah, John's Other Wife.
Oh, gee whiz.
Yes, indeed. I wish it had been Vic and Save, which is my favorite show, but
yeah,
it wasn't. And then back we came, and during that time in the Navy, I wasn't at sea fighting the Japanese very hard. I was in the Pacific, but I was on the island of Hawaii. I'd been surveyed off all sea duty for seasickness, because I was chronically seasick.
Oh.
And you have to be pretty seasick to get surveyed by the Navy, I can tell you.
Well, were you at, was this after the war?
No.
After the war started, I mean?
Yeah, this is after the war
after
started.
After Pearl Harbor.
Right, after Pearl Harbor, yeah. I went in like 4 months after Pearl Harbor. There was very little to do because I became the head of the Pacific Fleet Yeoman and Stenography School. By fatuous luck, I just happened to run into an old friend who was the assigning officer for officers who got in the pool there. And he said, what do you want to do? I got 100 jobs here. You can have any one of them. So I looked them all over and chose this one. This one was a junior grade, lieutenant junior grade, who reported to a vice admiral once every 6 months. That's the job for me. And I did. And I had five chiefs who really ran the school, knew what they were doing, and all I did was to check in the morning to be sure that they were there and sober, and in the afternoon, and I'd hang around a little bit, and otherwise I'd fight the battle of downtown Honolulu, which is done in cafes where the whiskey is, these are Navy operated that thing, where scotch is 4 cents and gin is 3 cents and has five kinds of fresh fruit in. They don't do that anymore.
No, indeed.
No. In fact, I was a member of the Marine Officers Club, and the slot machines there made so much money that Washington forced the Marine Club to give the money back. The only people they could give it back to, not the sailors who had come in from the ships to play, but the members of the club, and I got something like $1,500 that I didn't deserve. I never played the slot machine. And into my pocket, lucky? How lucky can you get?
That's the first one I've ever heard of that had a winning without gambling.
Reverse slot machine win, yeah. Don't pull the handle.
That's a good way to pass a Navy career, especially during the war, I would say.
Oh, yeah.
After the war, you got out of the service, you came back to Chicago?
Well, during that time, I wanted to work, really. You don't like to not work, or I don't like to not work. And I went around to KGU, which was the NBC affiliate, and said, you need anybody to do any announcing or anything? I work for NBC and WMAQ in Chicago. And the program manager just put his arms around me and said, buddy, you are the man I've been waiting for. Here's the key to the station. Take over at 9 o'clock and sign off at 1. Can you handle that? And I said, sure. And that's where I developed these verbal techniques that I told you about, and learned something about jazz, not a great deal. But I learned that if you talk directly to people, one night, for example, the first hint I got, there was a bank of phones on the wall, 10 or 15 phones, and I got taking a walking tour from my own house up LaSalle Street in Chicago, and then across down Dearborn and down Gothy, and then I think I crossed over and went over to the Michigan, and street by street and house by house. I don't know why I did this. I just did it. And that bank of phones began to light up like I'd never seen. And I did that for many cities that I knew something about. Fortunately, my father had been a troubleshooter for GE, and we'd lived in 15 or 20 cities. Mm-hmm. And I could do it for a lot of cities. And I found that if you directed yourself to individuals and things that concern them intimately, small things, not big things, that they really heard, and they really got a reaction. And I never forgot that lesson, I hope, and I use it today. So I got a whole bunch of information working. I think I worked 2 years almost doing that. For this nice guy who paid me a little money for it. Not much, but enough, you know. Then the war was over suddenly one day, and all the lights flared up in Pearl Harbor, and all the very pistols got shot off, and we came back, and there we were at NBC again. And then I found myself an announcer again, without a soap opera at this time.
As a staff announcer, you didn't receive any extra pay for the soap opera job that you did, or did you?
No. As a staff announcer, staff you job. Get staff. Yeah. I think it was $65 a week. Mm-hmm. And now all the boys were coming back, and there weren't so many soap operas around, soap opera jobs. And one day the chief announcer called me in and said, Garraway, two of the guys have got no way to get home except by the L, and you've got a car, so the 12 to 2 shift is going to be yours, because they'd have to, you know, take a cab or something, and you can drive home. And they live far north, and you don't live far north. Well, okay, fine. There was me in 2 hours, and there was me in my Hawaiian techniques. Mm-hmm. And first I was going to do it with popular music, and then I thought of symphonic music, and then a good friend of mine said, why don't you let me build you a really good jazz show? I know jazz, and he did very well. Mm-hmm. And he built a jazz show, and as he built it, I found that I didn't really know anything about jazz, but I discovered it. And as I discovered it, my enthusiasm for what I was discovering bubbled over and could be heard. And somebody in the ecstasy of happiness over something is an audible sound and transmits itself and transmits in both senses. It goes and makes the other guy feel good, too, I think. At least that was what I was told in hundreds of letters that came in during the years. And that show, the 1160 Club, it was called, 1160 mm-hmm. meaning midnight, or because it was a record by that title, very handy, was the first successful show we had. It was due to Jules Herberbowl, the program manager, that it stayed on, because I did a lot of verbal things in it that were eccentric by normal standards. Odd stories and offbeat stories that weren't usually told, a lot of which I swiped from the New Yorker magazine, for example. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you don't hear that on the radio very much. Well, not all from the New Yorker, but like my only joke. I don't tell jokes anymore. I've found that if I try to tell a joke, I step on the end so often, I'll screw it up somehow on the last word that I just try to avoid it. But I would say something like, I understand that the night watchman at the Audubon Society has been seen sleeping with his head under his arm. And standing on one foot, too. And just let it go at that. And this was all alone in a studio. Uh-huh. We were not allowed to have musicians as guests. There was a music strike on at that time. Uh-huh. Or no, that was just a general rule. No striking was involved. No musician could be a guest. It's very strange. So we had to do without guests in general. Occasionally we had non-musical guests, but not very many. Because I was interested in the point-to-point, person-to-person kind of communication, not the three-way, mm-hmm. triangular thing, which is an entirely different mechanism, and where empathy doesn't enter into it very much, mm-hmm. like empathy entered into that show. And do you know, would you believe, that today in 1976... I hear more people talk to me about the 1160 Club than I do about the 10 years I spent on the Today Show.
Well, that program is fondly remembered by more people than you realize, beginning to realize, but more than you know. It was a staple of Chicago radio from about 45, 46. Isn't that when it started?
Yeah.
And how long did you do that show?
It started in 47 and ran 47, 8, 9, and 50. Mm-hmm. 4 years. In 4 years, I felt I'd said my piece. I didn't want to... You know, you say something and you should stop when you finish saying it.
Well, by that time, you were also quite busy with a lot of other things.
True. Somebody had put the cable out from New York. And the same Jules Herbivore, who was the program manager and boss out here, came down to the office where Charlie Andrews, who was the guy that I worked with and whose ideas were more lush than mine, and he was a great creative writer for me. He and I were sitting talking, and Jules said, "I got this wire. Is there anything you fellas can do about it?" And he gave us the wire, and I read, "Can you fill network Sunday night, 9:30 Eastern Standard Time? Reply by Friday." Can you fill?
Now, you're talking about television.
Television,
right?
Right. Uh-huh. The cable has just come to Chicago.
Right.
I looked at Charlie, and to us, television was kind of a nuisance getting in the way of our radio plans. You know, we had this show coming in. But Charlie said, "Yeah, we can do some." And I said, "Yeah, tell him yes, Jules, sure. Tell him we'll fill." So he did. And
boy, how you filled that half hour.
Well,
that was Garraway at Large.
Yeah, that was Garraway at Large.
And the first time you did it, it was immediately on the network then, from Chicago
yeah,
East,
the first,
right?
Yeah, first one went to the net. Mm-hmm. And the first one was a hit. The first one, I couldn't believe the magnitude of the success of the first show. The phone calls that came in, mm-hmm. Cole Porter telephoned, Richard Rodgers telephoned. The switchboard was tied up for 2 hours from long-distance calls, mostly from New York, musical people. It was just incredible to us. We couldn't believe it.
What was the first show? It was in April of 1949. I think it was, according to some information that I've dug up.
48, wasn't it, I think. Well, I would have said 48, but I don't
know.
Well,
you were there.
What was it?
What did you do on that first show?
I don't remember. Haven't any memory at all, except walking around between the sets that we constructed out of a $5,500 budget we had for the show. Mm. Which is not very large, even then. Even then,
yeah.
It wasn't very large. So we just built some sets, and we had a big band, tremendous orchestra.
Joseph Galicchio,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
Uh-huh. That was because the union contract had contracted to have a big band at the studio.
Mm-hmm.
They were there all the time. They'd been there for years. In fact, they were there. After we left, they were there, and they used to come in and practice and play for nobody because the contract ran out.
Mm-hmm.
But so we did have this wonderful orchestra, fortunately, and we opened by me standing by Joe, and we hit a cymbal, and went up to me, and I said, "I'm a fellow named Dave Garraway, and we have some things here that might be of interest," and I'd walk over to the first set, and what we'd hired for talent were simply people on our own staff, mm-hmm. staff singers, with the exception of two dancers, I think, and one girl singer, Betty Chappell. Ted Mills was the producer of that show.
Mm-hmm.
He had a marvelous ability to pick talent. He could pick them out so well, and much of the show's credit belongs to him. I'd make some whimsical introduction, and they'd do a number, and I'd walk back in and make some crack, and then I'd walk along some more, and in the background you'd see ropes and ladders and
mm-hmm.
the stagehands talking, or not loud, but just normally, as they would, and I'd get to the next set, which would be a skyscraper beam or something, mm-hmm. which Haskell was painting something. And Jack Haskell was the singer on the staff. On the radio staff, mind you, not the television staff. There wasn't any television staff.
Yeah.
And that's all we did. Sounds simple. And I told two or three stories like Well, I'll tell one if I don't screw up the end. You want me to try?
Okay.
This is a true story. One spring day, a beautiful spring day, Charlie Andrews came out of the Wrigley building with a lunch date with Peg Heaton, the girl he went with, and it was a windy day, and the wind was coming up, and it was warm, and the fellas had rolled their shirt sleeves up, and the girls' dresses were blowing a little in the wind, and it was youthful time and spring and lovely, and Peg noticed a blind man sitting against the telephone pole with a paper cup or tin cup, but doing no business because nobody was looking down. People were looking up at the blue sky and the white clouds cutting along the top. And she said to Charlie, "Wait here just a minute, will you?" And Charlie said, "Sure." And she ran back to her office. She worked in an ad agency. And she made a little sign, not a big sign, about 6 by 9, and a piece of string and put it around his neck. And he did much better. And the sign said, "It is spring, and I am blind."
And that's the kind of a story you would tell.
Yeah.
It's a nice story.
And it is.
It captures the imagination, and I can see where it would be a beautiful lead-in to the next scene on Garraway at Large.
Wouldn't be a lead-in. That would be a separate thing.
Just
that,
a little go on. Between sets.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a collection of stories like that. I don't know what you call them, but...
Garraway stories.
Garraway stories.
How long did you do Garraway at Large?
Three years. Two and three-quarter years, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I think is the right number.
And the program came from Chicago the entire
then,
time?
Then we did it for two more years when we got to New York. It was scheduled to go on for the third consecutive year out of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
When suddenly Charlie and I were in Switzerland. We just arrived at Zermatt, in fact, and... I woke up first because we got a phone call, and somebody on the phone said, "Hello, Dave, your show's been canceled." And I said, "Okay." And then I opened the window, and there was the Matterhorn against the blue in the dawn. And the most breathtaking sight perhaps I've ever seen. So I went over and roused Andrews. I said, "Charlie, get up. You got to see the most beautiful sight you've ever seen in the world. I don't know. Come on, get up." And he got up, and, "Oh," he said, "that is gorgeous." And I said, "Our show's been canceled." A bitter thing to do.
And you climbed it and jumped off. Actually, from that, though, you jumped off to many other big things for Dave Garraway.
Here's luck again. I was living at the Ambassador East Hotel, and very seldom ever went in the pump room. But one Monday morning, mind you, when the place was closed, I went in just to write myself a couple notes on a piece of paper. There was a table there, and there was a weekly variety on the table. Somebody had left from the night before. And on it, it said, "Pat Weaver's Today." And I said, "What's that?" And I read about it. And I read some more, and I read some more. And I said, "That's my show. That is my show. That's built for me. Because all my life, I've spent gathering things about everything. I'm an encyclopedist, if anything. I'm a generalist. I'm a... universalist. I don't specialize in anything. I know a lot about a lot of things, more or less." And I called my agent, Bicky Devin, and said, "Bicky, got a variety?" "Yeah." "See about the Today Show?" Yeah, I thought about you. You want to try? Yeah. And it's like a fairy story. The next night, a fella dropped in from California on his way to New York, and we talked for a couple hours. His name was Mort Werner. He was the assistant to Pat Weaver, who was the head of the network. And I was called to New York to do an audition as a newsman, and they liked that. And one day later, I had a contract. Like that.
And you revolutionized morning television.
Well, there wasn't any morning television.
Well, that's, yeah. Well, all right. Yeah, you're right. You brought us morning television, and I don't think it's ever been the same.
No.
That started, well, no, I'm afraid to quote a date that I dug up.
Oh, 1952, January 12th, I can tell you there.
Okay.
Yeah, I have some dates I do have, right.
And how long did you stay on the Today
Show? I stayed on till about 9 3/4 years or something like that. In June 1961, I went off. What was I going to say? Well, it doesn't matter what I was going to
say.
Well,
you were there with Jack Les Cooley, Charles Van Doren,
yeah,
and
the original
Betsy Palmer, I think. Frank Blair, who just recently retired from there, didn't he?
He was the longest of them all.
And you got upstaged regularly by Mr. Muggs.
Oh, boy.
J. Fred Muggs.
Yeah, J. Fred Muggs probably saved the show. We had, you know, Pat Weaver is a great showman, and he supported that show for 2 years in the red.
Mm-hmm.
And we were still in the red when the boys who had owned J. Fred Muggs got in the elevator with the same Mort Werner on the first floor. And they had a contract with Mort Werner, and by the time they got to the fifth floor where his office was. And we put him on the show, and he was an instant hit, and the ratings went up quickly, right away.
Mm-hmm.
And it sold the show, really. And I willingly give Fred credit for saving that show.
That was quite a grueling routine
the
for you.
The little kids, the little tiny children, who at the very beginning were our greatest help, they found out that if you turned the buttons on in the morning, there'd be pictures too, just like at night.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't know what the words were, but their pictures. And then the folks would listen to the words and they'd understand them, and then we had an audience.
Mm-hmm.
So we're very grateful to babies and chimpanzees.
Well, we're grateful to you for providing so much good morning entertainment on television, too.
Well, we had
after a great nighttime shot with the Garraway at Large.
You'll never know what a satisfaction it was to do all those shows, really, the 1160 and today. Today I got up at 3:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I can never truthfully say I enjoyed the first 10 minutes of it at all. At all.
The first 10 minutes of getting up? Or the
of getting up.
Oh, yeah.
From 3:30 to 3:40 was, excuse me, I get the phone.
Okay, and we'll take a break then. We're talking with Dave Garraway. Our guest is Dave Garraway, and before we took a break, Dave was about to tell us the problems of getting up at 3:30 in the morning to do the Today Show.
Here, let me add that thing so I sound big. I sound like a kind of a waif there. In 10 minutes, the cold water and the orange juice did the work, and then I really looked forward to an exciting day because the Today Show had 5 or 6 new guests. I would not sometimes know who they were. Sometimes I would know who they were. I'd read their books if it was an author, and I read their books if it was an author. You can always tell, an author can always tell whether or not you've read his book, by the way. Always. In the first 10 seconds, he can tell whether you've read the book, the dust jacket, the book, or just thumbed through it. It's funny to watch their expression. And if you've read the book, their gratitude is a visible thing. But all kinds of people came on that show. Of course, we had 12,500 guests, we estimated, during the time I was there. Imagine whoever had a better job in the world than to be allowed to sit in a chair, have brought to him 12,500 interesting, exciting people, many of them beautiful girls, all the beautiful movie actresses and whatnot, and put down there for 5 or 10 minutes, talked to them, and then taken away, and another one put down, or a monkey in between. Couldn't be a better job, could there?
It sounds sensational.
No, and Barbara Walters gave that up for $5 million. Well, it's a little different now.
They never paid $1 million a year on the Today Show, did they?
No, they didn't. As a matter of fact, it was less than that.
Hour for hour, you actually did 3 hours live every morning.
For 6 years, we did 3 hours live, so we could cover the East and the Midwest zones fully live, repeating 1 hour. We repeated the first hour again in the third hour, which came out here only. And then the Coast put it on Kinescope, but the Coast... The Coast is another country, you know. It's insular. Uh-huh. They don't care about this part of the country.
Uh-huh.
You know, but I live out there now, and the news goes on. They put the news on at 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock. This is NBC. They repeat. It has a rating of 13. They put it on at 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock. It has a rating of 15. Then comes the John Chancellor, and the national news has a rating of 6.
They only care about the West Coast.
Same thing for CBS. Uh-huh. Cronkite has a rating of like 5 or 6 or 7. America is not to them one big broad country. While we were just as interested in what happened in California as what happened here, as I recall. But they are highly insular people. Of course, there's the New Yorker's map of the United States to keep in mind, which you remember very well.
You spent a lot of time with the Today Show, but when you left after a grueling, almost, 12 years, you say, you still stayed very active in television, and you had the a Dave Garraway show.
Well, I did...
Not at the same time, but you had been doing some of these things.
I did only one show after that called Exploring the Universe for NET, National Educational Television. Mm-hmm. And then I quit TV for quite a while, in fact. I found it that I wanted to do some other things.
Mm-hmm. And, while you were doing the Today Show, you pioneered again. You were a pioneer with Garraway at Large, and you were a pioneer with the Today Show.
Yeah.
And then you pioneered with the Wide, Wide World series.
That's true. That was an original effort of which it is a small part. I was the narrator, but the Barry Wood, who was the producer of that show, the old tenor with the Lucky Strike Orchestra, became a producer and was a magnificent one. And that show was some show to do, let me tell you. The Today Show being all ad-lib, that show, not a word dared to be ad-libbed because every word was a cue. We would have 80 cameras on an average, 80 to 90. We had 107 one time. And we had ridiculous things happen, like at the point where the golden spike is driven on the promontory point in Nevada, I think it is, or Utah, we arranged to have two trains pass that point at the same time, right over the golden spike at the same instant. And we did it. Somehow. Now,
this was all live.
All live.
90 minutes. It was on a Sunday afternoon.
Sunday afternoon. Uh-huh. It was no tape.
Yeah.
All live. And never would be done again, of course, because as soon as tape came in, it would be different.
And many years later, then we have the Wide World of Sports and the Wide World of Entertainment. But the Wide, Wide World was Garraway and NBC again, wasn't it?
Yeah. But we did some very good shows, not just freak stuff like that, or other stunt stuff like having the cameraman put a or having an aviator, I guess, put a camera, portable television camera, on his back and jump out at 25,000 feet, which we did. That wasn't such a big success because we couldn't persuade him to remember to turn the camera on. He didn't. And all we got was black all the way down. But we had a lot of stunt stuff occasionally like that. But we'd take stories of towns and people and villages and parts of America and go into them in depth. We could spend an hour and a half on them. And that isn't done much anymore. The quality of live people talking live is different, I think, than the quality of people who are talking on tape and know it can be repeated. Mm-hmm. I'm sure of that, very sure. I can't prove it, but and I've tried to test it, but it's too hard to test, really. But it's a natural thing. It's like a kiss. If you're kissing somebody and you know that you're alone, you're concentrating on the kiss. If you know that you're being observed, there's a third party who can have you repeat the kiss if it's not good. It's different, isn't it?
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think that's Heisenberg's principle, or somebody's principle.
You tried your hand at acting a little bit on television.
Yeah, I did, just for fun. I went to drama school for a couple of years out in Hollywood and took a couple parts on Smith and Jones. Uh-huh. And became a judge and yelled up and down, but that didn't seem really going to lead me anywhere. I didn't enjoy acting very much.
Well, you played Santa Claus for 2 years in a row, didn't you?
On a
Max Liebman production of Babes in Toyland.
Yeah, but that was a small thing to do.
Well, Dave Garroway is Santa Claus. It's a rare a rare Christmas present under a tree of television watchers, I think.
I'd forgotten all about that, by the way. It's true, a long time ago.
When you, after you said ho, 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 did you raise your hand to the camera and say peace?
No.
How did that come about? Where did that come from?
I don't remember. I remember that I did it, but I don't remember any details of it. My memories are spotty. They are small things, but not big things. I'll remember little bits and pieces of things, but I'm very likely to forget what year this show started or things like that.
Well, you've been very kind to share some memories with us today, Dave Garroway. I wish you the best of luck, and we look forward to seeing you again soon on the TV screen or turning on a radio or just enjoying the talents of a talented man.
Well, thank you. We have a show which is going to be a big show, and I hope I'm not too old to do it when it goes on. We presented it to the program heads of two networks, both of whom said the same thing. This is a show which will be on our network in 4 or 5 years without doubt. But if I took it to the program board now, I'd be thrown out in the street because the program boards they live by the minute, for the minute. Minute, mind you, not week. And it's too far ahead of its time. It's a show about the fact that the average age is going up in this country, and people are not learning how to retire, and people need to know how to retire and how to act after they have retired. And retiring itself is changing. A lot of things are going to happen. There'll be flexible retiring, for example, so that you can retire when you choose. That's in the process of happening, I think. And this show concerns that, but it's not a show about old people in any sense at all. It's a show 20% of which contains information of special interest to old people, and the rest for everybody, mm-hmm. so that everybody can watch it with a good rating setup. And old people buy things, too, you know. They eat and drink. And
people forget about that, don't
yes.
they, on TV. The executives, they forget that.
Yes, they do.
Well, here we go again with Dave Garraway working on a show that, like the others, is ahead of its time. We look forward to seeing it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Okay, Jack.